from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The extraordinary Hungarian dramatic film White God is about dogs who are abandoned because they're not purebred, and they seek revenge. Today we talk with Teresa Ann Miller, who trained the lead dogs and worked on a scene where over 200 dogs run through city streets terrorizing people. The dogs who trained for that scene?
The dogs just thought it was a party. I mean, they just, you know, they were just running to get to their other side because on the other side is where they were going to get all their treats and goodies. None of them were going to attack anybody.
Miller's father was also an animal trainer. The dogs he trained for the Beethoven films were family pets.
Even stranger than that, my father did Cujo as well. And I grew up with these St. Bernards. And it was then scary to go in the backyard at night and see one standing there looking at you.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews country singer Ashley Monroe's new album. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most gripping film performances I've seen in the past year was by a dog. Well, make that two dogs who share the leading role in the Hungarian drama White God. It won an award at the Cannes Film Festival for having an original aim and aesthetic. But I don't think many people in the U.S. saw it. It's just come out on DVD, so this is my chance to talk with Teresa Ann Miller, who cast the two leading dogs and trained them. She's trained animals for movie and TV roles for over 20 years. She initially worked with her father, who also trained animals for the screen. They both worked on the Babe and Beethoven films. But White God is unlike any film she's done, and perhaps unlike any that's been made, in that there are scenes with over 200 dogs running in a pack through the streets of Budapest, and there's no special effects, no CGI. The story revolves around a 13-year-old girl and her dog, Hagen. They're both deposited with her father in his small apartment when her mother, the parents are divorced, leaves for a trip. In the film, there's a new tax in Hungary on dogs like Hagen who are not purebred and are considered inferior. Rather than pay the tax and deal with the unwanted nuisance of a dog, the father forces the dog out of the car on the entrance to a highway as his horrified daughter protests in vain. The film follows the now homeless Hagen, who meets other abandoned dogs. Hagen is forced to become vicious when he falls into the hands of a dog fighter who trains him and enters him into a fight. Hagen and other discarded dogs eventually seek revenge against the people who have mistreated them. Teresa Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this film, and congratulations on the work that you did with the dogs. It's really remarkable. So what were you told that the director needed from you when you agreed to do the film?
They contacted me to do this film mostly because of the how ambitious the project was. This wasn't necessarily a film with an animal in it. It was a dog leading the film and telling the story.
So what were you told to look for in the dogs? What were you told they needed to do?
They had to have an acting range that should go from the most lovable, playful, endearing pet dog to this little girl, Lily, and find himself helpless on the streets, insecure, helpless, uncomfortable, unknowing. And then at one point, he has to transfer and kind of become this knower of all, runner of the streets, guardian of the city. So it was a huge range that they needed him to portray, from his innocence right up to his vigilance in, getting his...
Revenge.
Sorry, yeah, his revenge, thank you. His revenge on the people that kind of harmed him earlier on.
So how did you cast these dogs? How did you go looking for them? How did you find them?
Casting the dogs was, I thought, incredibly difficult because Cornell wanted that one dog
that's
who would
director.
Stand out. I'm sorry, Cornell Mandrutsko is our director. And he was very, very clear that this one lead dog had to be different than the other 250 dogs around him, mixed breed. So there's the challenge right there, to find that one in a million dog. However, he needed to have a photo double just for the amount of work that was scripted in the script, you know. And so it was a two in a million dog that we were looking for. And It was actually first based on his appearance, which sometimes it is here. That's kind of Hollywood, right? Hollywood via Budapest. It was appearance first. And of course, we wanted to be sure he was great with kids. And this dog had grown up in a family with small children, what have you. And from then on, the challenge was exposing him to everything. He'd never been out of his front yard. He lived in a very small town in Arizona. Hadn't seen very many things, hadn't seen cars and traffic, and it actually added to our experience in Budapest and kind of added to Hagen's experience on film, seeing things for the first time.
So would you describe what Luke and Bodhi look like? And these are the two dogs who share the role of the leading dog, Hagen, in White God.
Luke and Bodhi, the two lead dogs in the movie, they really are what we call a Heinz 57 mixed breed. When the director asked for one in a million, I think that's exactly what we delivered. They are an obvious cross of Labrador and Shar Pei. And I say that because of the shape of their heads are a little bit more Labrador, and their minds are brilliant, just very good companion dogs, very intelligent, very active. The Shar Pei, you can see in the wrinkles around their face and the little bit more compact body and the tail that comes up and around on the back. And then I even believe there's some hound in there somewhere because they howl. They howl in the morning. They howl at night. They howl. There's got to be hound dog in there somewhere.
So you found them like in a classified ad?
Yeah. So I contacted them and told them that I was an animal trainer and I'd be spending a lot of time with them. And I picked them up and brought them back to my place in California. I hadn't quite realized how much they didn't know. They grew up in that small yard, you know, out in the desert, kind of isolated from different things. And they'd never even been on leash before.
Wow.
And so from the very beginning, it was a huge, big experience for them.
The faces of the two dogs who you cast in the leading role of Hagen, these dogs' faces are so expressive. And when Hagen is forced out of the car and abandoned on the highway in the beginning of the movie, the dog looks so confused and so hurt and so sad. And he's there alone on the street, disoriented, as these like honking cars are driving past him at a high speed. It's just heartbreaking to watch. How did you get those expressions on the dog's faces? How do you get a dog to show emotion?
Everything that the dog does is a reflection of either my body language or my tone of voice. A lot of times, and the best example I can give you is in a lot of your obedience and Schutzen work, you give very, very direct cues, very one word and one syllable commands to the dog, and you get a quick reaction to what you're asking him to do, ultimately. So you would tell him to sit, stay, come, what have you. When you're working with animals in film, what we do is we use a much more relaxed attitude, a much more relaxed and loose personality in ourselves. So I might say, hey, get over there and stay. No, stay. Don't, oh, look, you know. And that kind of keeps him looking and keeps him guessing. And it gives him a little bit more range to be able to see what's going on around him, and yet I can keep his attention at the same time. In our commands, go over here, come, can you, good, lie down, good, look here, nope, hey, oh, what's over there, you know, and I might throw a little stone off to the left or to the right and give him something to look at and be confused by. And then I might change it real quick and say, hey, you should get up, stand up, back up, look. And now he might look a little confused. And then I'll say, okay, you can come out. So just to give you an example with my tone, and I am speaking over the entire film. I mean, everything that we do with those animals, you know, they have to dub when we're working with the actors. They have to dub the actor's voices over because that's how you get the best performance from an animal, is by him being able to hear and see you and react to the different various commands that you're asking him.
How do you get a dog to look sad, to look lost and abandoned?
To look sad and lost, what I do is just talk very slow. Put your head down and leave it and just watch. And they might sulk their head down a little bit and sulk their ears down. And we even taught Luke and Bodhi how to put their tail down. And they both have very curly tails. And I even taught them, put your tail down so he didn't look happy, and I'll just talk to him in that tone. And then I'll tell him to speak real easy, and he might give a little bit of a cry. And then I might tell him just to lie down and put your head down, keep it down. And he'll just react off my voice and off my body language and the kind of looks that I want him to get. And I might have my assistant co-trainer just shuffle the feet and a little bit in the ground to get him to look to the left and to look to the right. Everything done very low key, very sad, very slow tone. The reverse of that, of course, would be, hey, look here. Good, are you a happy dog? Can you speak, speak, speak? And now his tail's wagging and now he's up and everything. And at that same moment, I can say, now stop. And put your head down and watch. It takes a good couple of months to get to where we're in tune that way. And he knows to kind of mirror my voice and my body language.
Wow. So we've been talking about the two dogs you trained who share the role, the leading role of Hagen, the dog Hagen, in White God. And after this dog is abandoned and learns to fend for himself on the streets, along with other abandoned dogs, he's taken by a homeless man who sells the dog for a plate of food, and the dog winds up in the hands of a dog-fighting trainer. And the dog-fighter teaches this gentle, loving dog to be prepared to fight and kill another dog. So one of the things you had to train your dogs to do, or at least one of the two dogs, is to growl and to look vicious when he's baring his teeth. How do you train a dog to bare its teeth? Because usually that's a sign that the dog is really angry and ready to strike.
Keep in mind, they were only a year old when we were working with them. So they were quite young, quite playful. And what we taught them was to kind of build their confidence and make them a little possessive over a particular item. And kind of like it was in the film with that bone tied on the board. But we didn't beat him and abuse him and scare him into being aggressive. You know what I mean? All we do is let him have that, let him enjoy it, and now teach him to first just look at me while you're eating it. And then he'll look and I'll walk away. So he says, oh, okay, this is my bone. So now the next minute he's eating on his bone, I might look at him a little bit more, come in a little closer. And when he gives me a look for maybe 2 seconds, I'll walk away. And he's learning, oh, okay, so I get to keep this bone as long as I look and react to the trainer. And as we build this on, and it takes months to develop, and confidence, because, you know, they're not aggressive at all, and they don't mean it angrily. All I'm teaching them is a physical response to what I'm asking and allowing them to do. And so they put it together, actually, you know, after quite a few sessions, to where now maybe the lip might twitch and I'll just walk away and teach him, oh, okay. So each time he's learning that the more possessive or protective he gets over his bone, the longer he gets to eat on the bone. But at the same time, I can walk right up to him and pet him afterwards and say good boy and play with him ball and play with him everything else. So I'm really teaching him just to have that that reaction and that response to that particular article. And at no point does he do it anywhere else except for in that situation. So I can still work him with actors. I can still work him with children. I can still work him with all these things because, indeed, he is just acting. He's not angry or aggressive in any manner. And the interesting thing is both dogs were put in the same training at the same time, but Bodie just wasn't as good at it. Bodie did more of the deep barking and the deep anger growling was Bodie, but he didn't show any teeth for some reason. And Luke is the one who really, really could show his teeth and lift his lips so high. And so Luke got to do all of those scenes where you really see his teeth showing. And then Bodie on the other side gives the character a little bit more of that serious, dark barking attitude as if he's going to approach or attack, you know. So it was a good combination between the two dogs.
Were the growls that were used and the barks that were used from your actual dogs, or were they dubbed from other dogs?
They were, interesting enough, I learned this at Sundance from my director again, and he said that the dubbing of the dog sounds actually came from a studio in Belgium. And he says it was two guys in a studio who did all of the sound effects for the dogs. I mean, we had recorded barks
and
growls.
Do you mean it was like two men going woof?
Literally.
That kind of thing?
For the dog fight. Well,
really?
A little more believable, yeah. But,
well, I know.
But yeah, for the dog fight and everything, they laid all that in and the growling, that kind of situation. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And yeah, I was quite surprised. But everyone was saying, oh my gosh, the sounds were so brutal and everything. And Cornell says, actually, it was a couple of guys in Belgium in a studio who did
amazing.
The dog fight. And he said it was fascinating to watch. He says he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
So let's talk about the pack scenes. And I don't want to give away too much of the plot here, but there are scenes at the beginning and the end of the movie where there's a pack of over 200 dogs. Did you say 250?
Maximum was 250 dogs, yeah.
And these are like real dogs running in a pack down the streets of Budapest. I've never seen that many real dogs running like that. And they're running with a purpose. I mean, as the TV newscaster in the film said, they look like they're part of an organized army. And they kind of are, because they're out for revenge. So I know you didn't train the pack dogs. You trained the two dogs who share the leading role. But your dogs interact with the pack dogs, and I'm figuring you were around for those pack scenes. How much did your dogs interact with those dogs, and how much of it was just editing?
Quite a bit. We have definite shots of my dogs leading, and when I say my dogs, it was the animals that I supplied was the... Hagen character, of course, Luke and Bodie, and then the little Jack Russell Terrier was trained by April Morley, and she came from Los Angeles also.
And I'll just interrupt and say this is a little abandoned dog that Hagen finds when he's first abandoned, and they become good friends, but they're separated a couple of times during the course of the film.
Yeah, she's the first one to actually reach out to this lonely stray, you know, pup on the streets. And so we got together 2 weeks before filming. We met Arpad Halas and his team in Budapest.
That's the Hungarian animal trainer.
Exactly. He was the coordinator there. And we had probably about 12 of his dogs working with my dogs, because there were smaller scenes where they're interacting, first meeting each other, doing some of the more composed, smaller fights and wrestling matches and what have you. So we worked a good 2 weeks together for that. Then we had some additional time to get my dogs comfortable running in front of his pack of probably 50. I don't think we ever went higher than 50, 40 or 50. We started with 10 dogs behind him, 20 dogs behind him, just to give him the confidence that they weren't chasing him per se. It was more a pack run, but yet he had to lead it. You know, so again, here's this little boy from Arizona coming to Budapest. And he's seeing the world through a whole different pair of eyes now. But no, it was nice. It was a good relationship. It was a great experience for the dogs. And but no, he was not involved when we did the large pack runs, because it was too hard to predict and keep those other dogs behind him.
How do the dogs know to stay behind your dog, which was supposed to be the lead dog, literally the leader of the pack? Yeah,
they did not at all. It was all timing. We had their dogs behind a particular fenced area, and then I would have my trainers hand release.
Oh, I see.
My two dogs. And so on the timing, I would call my dogs, they would get the head start, and then we would release all the dogs behind them. And so that's the only way that we could predict. And there were several scenes when they got past. I mean, there were several scenes, but we cut before, you know, so you only see the beginning of it when the dogs are running to catch up with him. And then we just cut away from it before they actually took over his leadership. Then it looks like he's being overthrown. but no, it went quite well. They did a fantastic job. They had 4 months to prepare it. He has a beautiful dog school there outside of Budapest, where he teaches flyball and obedience and all your dog sports. And so he has a lot of contacts to a lot of dog owners besides his own dogs that he trains for local movies and what have you. And he had quite a lot of time to put that together. And what pushed the endeavor even another step was the fact that production and he made contact with a local animal shelter and actually incorporated animals from the shelter into that running pack as well. And that was amazing to see. That was fascinating. I've never seen it done. I've never seen such a large pack of dogs run together. And quite honestly, I don't think we'd ever do it here just for the time that it takes. You know, it's so much easier just to CGI it, but the director didn't want that effect at all.
My guest is Teresa Miller, who trains animals for movies and TV shows. The film we've been discussing, White God, just came out on DVD. We'll talk more about training animals for movies and TV shows and about growing up with the movie star animals her father trained after we take a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter wants business owners to know that summer is a great time to hire the best people because there's less competition for quality candidates due to vacation season. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to hundreds of job boards with one click and watch your qualified candidates roll in to a single, easy-to-use interface. And for Fresh Air listeners, ZipRecruiter is offering a free trial. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/freshair to get started.
So during at least one of the scenes where the pack is running, there are some people who are on the streets and are totally and understandably panicked. So you have people who are acting, because they're actors, acting as if, or stuntmen, whatever, but they're acting as if they're totally panicked. That could easily upset the dogs, right? So did you train the dogs to be comfortable around people who were acting as if they were panicked?
We did, but they didn't really, I mean, they just thought it was a party. I mean, they just, you know, in the early training, Arpad would have his trainers run through the packs of dogs and in front of the packs of dogs. And again, the screams are put in later. The music helps, you know, sell it. And the panic, a lot of it was shot, you know, a little bit separately. And the dogs chasing the woman into the car. And so the dogs just thought, again, it was just a big party. And none of them were going to attack anybody or to necessarily stomp on anybody. They were just running to get to their other side because on the other side is where they were going to get all their treats and goodies. And so whatever obstacles were in the way, they would find their way around it, you know. So it actually worked out well to incorporate the people running ahead of them and running inside, you know, the pack as well.
So where were you during the running of the pack scenes?
I was there. I was there.
They're in the middle, they're on the side.
Coordinating the timing, coordinating the collection, being an extra set of eyes, you know, to be sure. You know, when we started the pack running, we would set up this pen around the corner of a building. And the dogs, we'd rehearse the dogs maybe once just to see their path. But before that, you know, I'm on set making sure that, well, I don't want them to come around the corner blind. We should block this street light with something. We should be careful with this fire hydrant. I want to be sure that nobody's coming out of this door. Let's make sure that when the camera is on the camera car, we need to put boards around it. It was a little ATV that the camera was on, and we had somebody driving in front of the pack dogs, and there was a spotter in the front to be sure they weren't close to any dogs. But I also wanted to make sure that there were bumpers around the side so no dogs could accidentally go in front or underneath it. And so this was all part of my job and my experience in working here in Hollywood, was to take that, especially the safety aspect, and make sure that all of those things were in place over there in Budapest to be sure that all the animals were being treated, you know, checking their pads after they run to be sure we're not wearing them down. Just everything, just coordinating the whole sense and foreseeing things that somebody else might not foresee, you know, when I'm not working my dog in that scene as well.
And I just have to ask you, you know, we mentioned that the dog is trained to be a fight dog and there is a fight scene and it looks really vicious. I'm sure these dogs weren't attacking each other in real life on the set. What were they doing?
They were playing like crazy. Again, this is something, you know, it took us a good 4 weeks in Los Angeles to introduce the two dogs and to see who was going to be the best wrestlers. And again, Luke being the silliest, he's really the silliest out of the two. Bodhi is the more sensible. I'm going to see what happens first. And Luke, he's the jump in and be crazy. He's a nut. He's going to act first and think about it later. And it worked really well for the play scene because he really enjoyed playing with the Rottweiler. And in teaching him, and Bernard was wonderful. He was the Rottweiler. And he loved to roll and scratch his back and roll on the carpet and what have you. And so we'd build up these little play sessions. They didn't see each other except for when they were playing in the fight ring. And so we would do that 2 to 3 times a day. We would get the two together and just let them wrestle. Just let them wrestle in the ring. They can see each other. We'd say, get him, get him, get him. And we'd encourage them to go, you know, tackle or play with the other one. And eventually they built up a great trust between them. And we were able to get longer and longer sequences of them playing. The difficult thing about filming that scene is that, you know, they get tired and bored after a little bit. And so we were shooting at that location for a full week. And we would start our days in the dogfight arena and let the dogs play in the fresh of the morning and see each other and take advantage of that energy. And then sometimes at night when we wrap. So it actually took a week to shoot that scene to get the most footage that we could out of their wrestling match. But indeed, they were really just playing. They learned to be great play buddies. Bodhi never quite liked it. He didn't really trust the Rottweiler. He's my sensible one. And so he didn't really partake in the wrestling match. However, he is in the ring when the handler's holding him and he's doing his deep bark and growls and trying to get away and get away from the actor to go get the Rottweiler. That was his big participation in that scene.
You adopted the two dogs who you trained for the Hungarian movie White God. I can see very easily how you fell in love with them and why you'd want to keep them. Did you or your father end up living with the dog or dogs from the Beethoven films?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Oh, really?
Of course. Yeah. St. Bernard's at the house, Great Danes at the house growing up. Even stranger than that was, you know, my father did Cujo as well. And I grew up with these St. Bernards, you know.
This is Cujo, it's from a Stephen King horror novel.
Oh my gosh.
And the dog is bit by a bat and becomes this kind of like monster dog.
Yeah, and interesting was, yeah, he gets rabies, terrorizes this whole little southern, you know, western coast or what have you. And I mean, I'd seen him training the dogs and I knew the dogs as pets and never had any qualms. And I know he went to go do the movie and he came back. And it wasn't until I saw the movie, I was honest to God, I was terrified of these dogs after seeing the movie. I just couldn't believe it. And it was then scary to go in the backyard at night and see one standing there looking at you. It just changed my whole, you know, and that's just amazing. I mean, when someone can do that, I mean, those are my pets. Those are my St. Bernards at home. And they got me to second guess them after seeing that movie. That was something.
But got over it.
Oh my gosh, that movie was tough. Yeah, it was just really interesting how it, you know, you have to put the reality into it that like, no, these are your dogs. It's all good. It's all. But that was my dad's specialty, was doing the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of characters. And he did it in the movie White Dog. That was a Samuel Fuller movie with a white German Shepherd, as well as Cujo and They Only Kill Their Masters and the Doberman Gang. I mean, that was his specialty, doing Amityville Horror, all of the dogs that did the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So this was my first chance to be able to do that type of genre that he'd done for so many years so well.
So there's a scene in the first Beethoven film, which you both worked on, that you and your father, that's the kind of family-friendly comedy version of a scene in White God, the Hungarian drama. And it's a scene where people have been keeping dogs caged for malevolent reasons, and the dogs get out of the cages and seek their revenge. And in Beethoven, the dogs are these like cute little dogs, and they're running after a very young Stanley Tucci and Oliver Platt, who are going like, ah! And in White God, it's just like huge pack of dogs, and it's really dramatic and serious.
I hadn't even considered that similarity in that pack scene, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, and it's basically the same theory, just with so many, you know, fewer dogs running in the pack.
And one's played for laughs, and one's like pure drama.
Sure.
So I have to tell you one of my
funniest memories of that particular scene was we had a golden retriever named Sandy. And Sandy, again, was a pet that lived at our house, but he played the dog on the TV show Punky Brewster in the 80s. And a beautiful little golden retriever. So we put him in the pack scene to run with the rest of the dogs. He was off that week. And we put him in that scene. And it's funny because when they run through the fruit market and knock over all the fruit stands and everything, that silly dog picks up, it's either a cabbage or a melon, and runs with it in his mouth because he's a retriever. He couldn't just leave all that good fruit behind. And it's funny, if you see the first Beethoven like that, you'll actually see Sandy picking up the fruit and running with it in his mouth. And he's not supposed to, but he just couldn't help himself. So that was just a very cute memory that I have from that particular scene.
Oh, that's just hysterical.
It is funny.
So your father was training animals for movies and TV when you were growing up. How did you decide you wanted to go into that profession too?
I would help him. I would go to work with him on weekends and during summer break, you know, I'd help him. Always if he was working with a kid, you know, my brother and I got to be that kid who got our faces licked and had to walk with the dog or had to have the dog lay on us or what have you. You know, we would essentially just help him with his training. And my house was more or less the house to be at. I mean, we always had different things there. We had, you know, chickens one day and a little raccoon the next day. And we even had a seal in our bathtub one time overnight because my dad was working the seal the next day. And I mean, it was just a blast. I mean, it was just such an experience growing up, you know, to be surrounded by so many different critters and what have you. And later on, as I got closer to finishing high school, I was really kind of leaning into going into photography and thought I would work with him just to kind of get to make some contacts and some people and see what I can do as far as being a, you know, maybe a still photographer in the industry. Well, the longer I worked with him and the more we worked together, we really clicked. I mean, we really had a great understanding, you know, of working together as a team. And I learned so much from him in working with the dogs, and I loved it so much that I just continued. I mean, I loved it that much, and I was enjoying it more, and it turned out to be something that I was good at. And so as I was able and learned and accomplished more, you know, he would send me out on bigger and different jobs, and instead of just background jobs, I'd get to do character jobs now and, you know, jobs with cats and what have you, and that's really how it developed. And my brother's in the industry as well, but not as a dog trainer. He specializes in reptiles, alligators, snakes, insects, all those type of things. And that's really his specialty since he was young. You know, he had the snakes growing up as a kid, and that was always more his direction. And so we're in it together, but doing different aspects of it in the same, you know, category here. So, but yeah, so that's just what happened. We worked together quite well, and it was something I really enjoyed doing. And I, you know, how can you not love working with the animals?
Did your brother supply the flies that are buzzing around a dead dog in White God?
No. And again, I'm gonna ruin your movie. that was actually just kind of a sound effect.
Okay.
And there may have been some gnats nearby or something, but we didn't really have flies around it too much. It was an artificial, you know, stuffed dog that was laying on the side of the road, and we kind of grunged it up and put some. And to get Lukey to come in there and really look at it and figure out what happened to this dog, we put some noise buzzers underneath him. And every time I would push a different buzzer, he would look left, he would look right, he would look under the dog. And that would really make it look like he was trying to figure out what happened to this poor dog, because I couldn't be there to try to get him to look in the proper direction. And so that's another little trick that we have, you know, is put little noisemakers underneath it, so that when he heard it one way, he'd look left or look right.
How did your father get into the business of training animals for movies and TV?
Originally, my father was a Air Force dog handler, in Lompoc, California, here on the West Coast at Vandenberg Air Force Base. And he would train sentry dogs to protect the missiles at the Air Force Base because he was bored, basically. He didn't like working these night shifts with nothing to do but guard these missiles, and so he signed on to take on a sentry dog, and now he had his sentry dog as companionship and to help protect the missiles. But in his spare time, he would train the dog because he was also still bored and wanted to do things with his dog. So he actually got famous around town because he was this Air Force airman who had a sentry dog who would push a baby stroller down the street or dress up and wear a bonnet and do all these cute and clever tricks as well as guard the missiles. And he met my mother, who worked nearby there. He used to do obedience classes and what have you. And so she, of course, signed her dog up to get to know him. And once he got out of the Air Force and after I was born, he started contacting Franken Incorporated, Rudd Weatherwax, Carl Spitz, all of the trainers that were actively working with animals in film at the time. And finally got an offer after being persistent and bugging. He finally got Franken to give him a chance and give him a dog to train. To find out what skills he had. And one of those dogs was the original Benji dog who was in Petticoat Junction as Higgins. And he used to work on those shows with him. So that's kind of how he got started, was just apprenticeship and learning from working with the trainers that worked in that company, handling various types of animals. And the rest is history. He finally got his own company in 1977. And ran his own company for, gosh, almost 30 years.
So you've trained cats as well as dogs to perform in movies. I think it's much harder to train a cat than a dog. How do you train a cat? What's the incentive?
Yeah, the incentive for working with a cat or a chicken or a pig or what have you, most of your animals that don't necessarily work for praise like a dog. I think a dog is the only animal that genuinely wants your attention and your affection and praise. Working with the other animals is typically working with a food reward, and it doesn't mean starve the animal. It just means that when the animal is in training, that he's learning while he's getting his breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So he's not being deprived in any way. It's just that while he's doing his learning, he's getting his regular meals. And so, and the difference also being on a project where I might have one or two dogs to play the role of the lead character, with a cat, you'd probably have four or five cats. Because, again, you don't have that food drive for very long. Once they get a little full, well, now they're not interested in working anymore. You know what I mean? And so now you would bring in the second cat to try to continue your day and work out for the rest of the scene. So it is quite different. It is quite different working with them, but you still can teach them how to retrieve, how to go to point A to point B, how to go and rub up on an actor. You've seen it in all your cat commercials or what have you. So there's quite a bit you can still teach them to do. It's just what they're limited to physically, you know, between their size and their physical abilities.
Teresa Miller, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Teresa Ann Miller trained the animals for the Hungarian film White God, which has just come out on DVD.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message come from SimpliSafe Home Security, the smart way to protect your home or small business. SimpliSafe is a wireless system with no annual contracts and around-the-clock protection. It's never been easier to make your home safe. Tech experts at CNET call SimpliSafe better, smarter home security. You can try this wireless alarm system, get a 10% discount, and show support for this show by visiting SimpliSafe. That's SimpliSafe.com/fresh air.
Ashley Munro, a country singer still in her 20s, has just released her third studio album, The Blade. Munro is also a co-founder of the group The Pistol Annies, along with Miranda Lambert and Angelina Presley. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Munro's new solo album is a collection of deceptively pretty songs that cohere as a strong, serious piece of work. We'll be right back.
When the news was announced recently that Miranda Lambert and Blake Shelton were getting a divorce, some country fans doubtless felt a secret thrill of pleasure. They know that some of the best country music comes from heartache, so who knows what excellent music this pain might yield, especially from Lambert, much the better songwriter of the two. In a way, however, we already have a sense of how that kind of pain could be framed in this new album by a close friend of Lambert's, Ashley Munro.
I let your love in, I have the scar, I felt the razor against my heart.
That's The Blade, the title song of this album, the only one Munro didn't have a hand in writing, but she certainly stakes her claim on its sharp emotions. And Miranda Lambert joins her on the chorus. Because Ashley Munro sings in high, curling tones with the smoothest of phrasings, it's easy to hear past what she's saying. Not just in the lyrics, but in the jagged little edges attached like a razor-toothed zipper to so many of her songs. One of my favorite examples of this certainly is this one, If the Devil Don't Want Me. If you listen to The Blade from start to finish, you notice a few things. One is that the album, co-produced by Vince Gill and Justin Niebank, gets more hardcore country as it goes along. The songs Munro might hope to get played on country radio are front-loaded here, and through no irony at all, given the country music industry today, they're the more pop music tunes. But delving deeper into the album yields a different kind of pleasure, such as the song Dixie, an old-fashioned story song about wanting to escape from the small-mindedness of small-town life. It's that rare country song that positions fleeing to the big city as an escape to freedom. Sometimes I hear a little bit of Dolly Parton in Munro's performances. There's a firm delicacy to her phrasing, a backbone of strength that's sometimes bent from sorrow. I noticed a striking quote from a recent interview Munro gave. People always ask, she said, "Are you sad all the time?" Imagine being thought of as eternally unhappy. Actually, I would guess that Ashley Munro might take a secret joy in that, since it means she's done her job so convincingly.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Ashley Monroe's new album, The Blade. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, there's a saying about drunks that men wake up in jail cells, women wake up in strangers' beds. That generalization rang true for Sarah Heppala in her drinking days when she considered alcohol the fuel of all adventure. We'll talk about her new memoir, Blackout, in which she wrestles with how drinking fit in with and distorted her idea of being an empowered woman. I hope you can join us. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.